is Vigatone versus PMAG, Mr. Grimm. Right, exactly. It's important for the take.
Yeah.
May it please the panel, counsel, Terry Grimm for the appellant and appellee, PM Ag Products. Reverse this case, Your Honors. The fraud verdict cannot stand, and the contract verdict can't stand either, save for the one undisclosed contract about which proper damages were never proven. In this case, the purchaser bought a company for $39 million after 7 months of investigation. The first month they were told in a letter, page 30 of our brief, if you're going to rely on anything, let us know now. Otherwise, only a definitive written contract will control. Guess what? They never told us anything about their policy against market risk of pigs, and this was a farming business. We're selling feed to animals, to swine and pigs.
Well, selling feed and speculating on commodity prices are completely different businesses.
Of course they are. We weren't speculating.
But you were speculating.
Well,
you didn't have those. You didn't have your offsetting contracts to shift the risk of the pig prices going through the roof.
Actually, this time they went through the floor. But they did go through the roof later. But, Your Honor, that's why we gave them the contracts. And 3.9, which is part of the contract, as their client admits, says that here are 43 or 44 contracts, all of which could cost you more than $100,000 per each.
Those are the contracts to buy the pigs, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you had told these people, you had told the plaintiff, that you had offsetting contracts to sell the pigs, so that there would be no market risk. You made repeated representations to that effect, and you know maybe the plaintiff was careless in not demanding copies of those offsetting contracts, but you told them that, and isn't that fraud?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because number one, the jury should have never heard the evidence. When they came to see us for the first time, their own person wrote down, quote, any risk in sourcing pigs? Answer, got to pay for the pigs and place them at the feeders. In their own admission, they were expecting 250,000 pigs per year in this program. That's a lot of pigs.
Okay,
these contracts were disclosed, and their reckless lawyer didn't read them.
What do you mean they were disclosed? You didn't give copies of the... Well, no, they had the contracts, but the point is you said that this was a no-market risk operation, which implied that you had offsetting sale contracts, and you didn't.
That evidence was disputed, Your Honor, but
the jury
should have never
heard it. Of course it's disputed, but we're not the jury, so we have to construe the facts in the way most favorable to the verdict that the record will support. I thought your real argument was that the integration clause was somehow a defense.
Well, of course it is, Your Honor, but it's more than just the integration clause. It's the non-reliance clauses as well. Now, the integration clause is a standard, fairly broad one, which, unlike the case in Astor, which opponents rely on, did talk about prior representations. But there were more. The next anti-reliance clause, 5.7, says that the buyers acknowledge and agree that no one is making any express or implied representations. It's all in the agreement. And they also said that they're not making any implication about a warranty or the express value of any asset, which would include all of these contracts.
Yeah, but then you have a warranty clause.
Well,
that's telling the court, because you seem to be giving with one hand or taking back with one hand what you were giving with the other.
Oh, well, that's 3.28, Your Honor, and 3.28 was an unambiguous clause that said, yes, these are warranties, and the warranties covered several pages in the brief, and not one of them mentioned the market risk on any pig contracts, and incorrectly, the court below agreed with an interpretation that 3.28 made the unambiguous integration and non-reliance clauses somehow in play. And it just couldn't, Your Honor.
Well, I don't understand you, because it says, I'm looking at page 12 of the appellee's brief, the indented quotation, the bottom four lines says, bottom five lines, to the best knowledge of PMAG, that's you, there is no fact which adversely affects or in the future is likely to adversely affect the purchase assets of the business in any material respect. It hasn't been set forth, et cetera.
Yes,
well, it's a very material fact that there were no offsetting sale contracts to eliminate the market risk.
Your Honor, only those representations made pursuant to the terms of the agreement.
That's the previous sentence.
Well, you have to read, I think, the whole paragraph.
I don't understand. Of course you have to read the whole paragraph, but the sentence I read is adding to what's in the previous sentence. The previous sentence is about information in the schedules, but this sentence is a very broad warranty. It doesn't really jive very well with the integration clause, but there it is. That's what the judge thought. You had an ambiguity in a contract because you had inconsistent seeming clauses.
I think what Judge Leinweber below, and I respectfully suggest he was in error, said this agreement, you can read out the terms pursuant to the terms of this agreement. We gave them.
Look at the sentence I read.
I'm looking right at it, Your Honor. And my note
it
is.
It doesn't say anything about.
My note is they lose here, too, because the fact of the contract was disclosed, and as their expert Charnetsky said,
the risk was
known by reading them.
No. That's the part of your briefs that I find particularly incomprehensible. There were contracts to buy pigs, but you represented to the plaintiffs that there were also contracts to sell pigs. Now, the fact that they read the contracts, or should have read, or had the contracts to buy the pigs, didn't mean they had the contracts to sell the pigs. And the non-existence of those contracts seems to me, a jury could decide, was a fact which adversely affected the business.
I don't think so, Your Honor, respectfully citing all three anti-reliance and integration clauses in the plain language of 3.28. That was tried in the Kellogg case in the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit said, hey, look, you didn't get this pursuant to the agreement, and, Your Honor, let's stress that 3.9, the schedule attached to the agreement, is part of the agreement, and these contracts, 2 to 9 pages in length, can be seen.
Well, we were just talking about 3.28.
Yes.
And I don't see what you're saying now has to do with 3.28.
Well, Your Honor, what it has to do with 3.28 is if you got it pursuant to the agreement, you got these contracts, they're easily read, they're easily understood.
No,
but
you keep getting back to that. But the contracts to buy the pigs are not the contracts to sell the pigs.
They
don't buy the pigs and sell the pigs to the same person.
But, Your Honor, they admitted that if I had read these contracts as opposed to my lawyer who read them, as opposed to my expert due diligence accountant who may not have read them, I would have known right away I would have not closed. I would have never closed. These are Schaub's own words, unless I saw the offsetting contract. Now, I think it's a real stretch to get from the evidence in this case that we promised them the pigs had been offset. I'll get off that for a second, Your Honor, because, as you know, I have other grounds for reversal, including the fact that the instruction on reliance was wrong as a matter of law in Illinois. The word reckless was used 4 times. It's not a reckless standard in Illinois.
Well, what do you
anymore.
Think? You think it's a negligence standard?
No, but it's not reckless. It's
then
a
what
prudence.
Is it?
Read Cozy, Judge Williams' opinion, following the Jarrell case and the Adler versus William Blair case. You cannot have an opportunity to read a document in front of you and know the consequence of it and then justify it, finally rely. But I'd like to come back to
In Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Mayer, he says the reliance requirement excludes recovery if the investor, in this case it would be the purchaser of the business, knows or suspects the truth.
They knew the truth.
No, they didn't know the truth. They thought, or at least the jury found, they thought that there were offsetting contracts.
No, Your Honor, they could not have, because no offsetting contracts were disclosed in 3.9. 3.9 as part of the agreement. They're bound to read 3.9 and know all of the contracts in it.
Sure, but
when they read those contracts, they know they're not upset.
You have represented in the sentence that I read from 3.28 that there's no fact which adversely affects the business and that that isn't disclosed. And what is not disclosed in the agreement is the non-existence of the offsetting sale contract.
I think that's parsing it pretty fine, but I actually disagree with your observation, Your Honor, because when you get 3.9, which constitute exceptions to the contract, you're on notice of everything in there, and you get the contracts which say you can't, you're buying all these pigs. When you don't get the ones that say hazel are also sold at the same time, you're on notice. It was... There was no trouble with the point person from the plaintiff below saying, absolutely, had those contracts which should have been read, we would have never closed. So we didn't tell them.
Right. Not so you're saying they're careless because they didn't demand the contract.
Well, they did demand the contracts, and we gave them to them.
No, they wanted the offsetting sale. They didn't say, you've told us there are offsetting contracts, show us the contracts. They didn't do that. That was careless. Isn't that what it comes down to?
No, Your Honor. It comes down to a lack of prudence. They read the truth
was... Well, lack of prudence is a synonym for carelessness.
Well, carelessness is less than recklessness. I say you don't give a jury an instruction that you must prove recklessness four different times. That's not an IPI instruction, and we submitted proper IPI instructions. But let me go a step further, Your Honor.
Have given a lack of prudence instruction?
Sure.
That's not a standard instruction either.
Well, the standard instruction in IPA was what IPI is what we provided.
And it said what?
And I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor, but it did not say reckless.
What did it say?
And you've caught me out. I believe it. It's just in the normal language of the IPI.
So what is the normal language?
The IPI says what you can justifiably. It talks about what you can justifiably rely on. And you can't justifiably rely on something when the truth is right in front of you. Now, there are other reasons.
But there's a difference between the truth being in front of you and you're being careless and failing to inquire and discover the truth.
Well, let's start with the truth is right in front of them. Because knowing that there's terrible risk in these contracts and they're not passed through...
The truth is right in front of them and recklessness are the same thing.
Recklessness
and having the truth in front of you are the same thing. Recklessness is... a known risk, and you fail to do anything.
I would agree that that's reckless, but I don't think it's a reckless standard under justifiable reliance under Illinois law anymore. And I also urge upon the court Burrill, which says it's not a Supreme Court case, but it's the most recent expression of the First District. It says you've got a fully integrated merger clause. You can't claim oral fraud. And remember, Your Honor...
There, what about the Salkeld case? Do you know the Salkeld case? Illinois Appellate Court, 1989.
No, I'm not...
Well, it says the opposite of Burrill.
Well, Burrill is later.
Burrill's never been cited, though.
Well, it's fairly recent.
He's never been cited.
1997
case. Your proposition. Yeah, it's had 5 years to collect.
Right.
Now, the general law is against, though, right? General law is that the general rule in the country is that an integration clause is not a defense to fraud. You're relying on some special Illinois rule.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. Read Jackna V., which we persistently misspell, and I apologize to the court. Read 101. Read Harsco out of the Second Circuit. That's not the law.
Well, yeah, but look, read Farnsworth on contracts. The general rule is that an integration clause is not a defense to fraud. It's a contract doctrine. It's not a fraud doctrine.
Read Rissman in this circuit, Your Honor. These are non-reliance clauses as well as integration clauses. I'm into my rebuttal time, but I would like to observe, Your Honor, that if these clauses didn't exist, let's say they weren't here. Let's say we had 3.28 and that's all we had. And let's say it means exactly what my opponent says it means, which of course I dispute. This case should be retried because of the exclusion of the devastating impeachment evidence that Judge Leinenweber wouldn't let me put in. No jury would have ever believed these guys if I'd have been able to trot out the admission of their accountants that we knew all about these contracts and we knew they hadn't been passed through and we knew there was substantial risk.
Did you agree to a confidential arbitration proceeding?
Your Honor, that was an agreement that could have been worked around. We could have proved up the extrinsic evidence with of impeachment with never mentioning the arbitration agreement. And besides, my argument is that
mentioning the arbitration, you'd agree that what went on in the arbitration was confidential.
Not quite, Your Honor, because first of all, we had a counterclaim based on the arbitration agreement, which they paid just before trial. So the argument that we didn't have any right to rely on the arbitration agreement, frankly, given the way this case was tried, amounts to a miscarriage of justice. I can say it just that strongly. And lastly, as Your Honor knows, the damages were pretty casually proved up here. The expert said first, you know, these contracts are very risky. That's what I knew by reading them. That was great. I didn't need too much more. And then he said, I didn't give you any credit for the money you made on these contracts because we weren't supposed to be speculating. We both agreed. You're supposed to do these contracts to tie up the business of the farmers. Your Honor, I'd like to save a minute for rebuttal,
yes, of course,
if I may. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Mr. Trella.
May it please the Court. I need to begin by pointing out and apologizing for an error in our brief. At page 21 in the standard of review section, we indicate that the standard of review when a district court reduces a jury's damage award is somewhat more exacting than ordinary abuse of discretion review. That had been the standard prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Gasparini, but as this court made clear in the Medcom case, which we cite elsewhere in our brief for another proposition, ordinary abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard now. We just missed that, and I apologize for that oversight. Mr. Grimm talked about Schedule 3.9 to the agreement and the fact that certain of these pig purchase contracts were in fact produced and reviewed. But as Judge Posner pointed out, the issue here is, were there offsetting sales? And our client was clearly told that there were offsetting sales. And I'd also point out, and the evidence is very clear on this, and it came from PM Ag's own witnesses, that in the industry, the term pass-through, the term pig placement, the term pig sourcing agreement, means that there are offsets, either that the intermediary is acting purely as a broker, bringing buyers and sellers together, or that there are, you know, simultaneous back-to-back purchases and sales. So when they use those terms, they are saying, and the jury could certainly find, that they are saying there are offsetting sales contracts.
How did your folks miss this when they were reviewing the transaction? I mean, that to me is the biggest stumbling block to your position in this case, frankly. I mean, they'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind to have missed this.
Well, I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. They had been told up front repeatedly that there were these offsets. This is a no-risk program. It's a pig placement. It's a pass-through program. We never own the pigs. They just go from the nursery to the farmer.
If you read the contracts, you were at least taking title of the pigs, right?
Well, you knew you were purchasing those pigs.
Yeah.
But you had been told that there were offsetting sales. And I think it's important to note, Your Honor, that Schedule 3.9 was not intended to be and did not purport to be a list of all of the contracts that Vigortone had. There was a $100,000 threshold on the disclosure in there, and there was testimony at trial, and we cited in our brief, that the expectation was that under the pass-through program, most of the purchasers from Vigortone under the pass-through program would be smaller farmers who'd purchase 1,000 or 2,000 pigs, which would come under this $100,000 disclosure threshold. So meanwhile the nurseries that produce the piglets tend to be large operations. So it's not at all surprising or inconsistent with the representations that were made that you have some purchase contracts on here, but not offsetting sales. Let me also point out, Your Honor, that there were other misrepresentations.
I could stay on that one just
sure.
for a moment. Suppose we were to disagree with you with respect to the wording of this contract. I think the contract clearly contains both an integration clause and a non-reliance clause. Where does that leave your fraud count?
I think the jury verdict should still be upheld, Your Honor, and here's why. And I'll come back to this, but I disagree that there's a non-reliance clause.
I understand that. Yeah, I'm giving you a hypothetical.
Right, I understand. There were misrepresentations made in the contract itself, in the schedules that were attached to the contract, and under no reading, and PMAG doesn't suggest any reading of the integration clauses that would preclude reliance on that. Let me give you some examples. There were financial statements in Schedule 3.4 to the agreement. They were provided pursuant to the agreement. So whatever Section 3.28 means, this was clearly part of what was being warranted. There was a warranty that they fairly presented Bickerton's financial condition. There was a warranty in particular about accounts receivable. These financial statements were fraudulent, and PM Ag knew it. They had hidden the animal inventory and the losses resulting from it in an account called miscellaneous receivables. The account had a $1.8 million balance in these financial statements that were provided. Well, it turns out that $1.8 million consisted of $500,000 in losses on the pig contracts. It consisted of the pigs that they actually held, various expenses, and their own controller testified that he had called this to senior management's attention before the transaction, and they said, leave it alone. Just send the financial statements out the way they are. So there's one clearly fraudulent, admittedly fraudulent statement, Your Honor, that is unaffected by these contract
related
arguments.
Tell me how that fraudulent statement would have affected the transaction, though. I mean, you knew of those pig contracts. The fact that they dumped it in this miscellaneous accounts receivable thing, did that really affect the decision of your client?
I think so, Your Honor, because, again, we arguably knew about the purchase contracts, but we didn't know that there weren't the offsetting sales. But had we seen animal inventory, had we seen, you know, pig trading losses, that would have made a huge difference.
Pig trading losses were also dumped into that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. That is, and by pig trading losses, I mean the difference between what they were paying for these pigs, and then they were able to sell some on the spot market, even though they didn't have sales commitments. I would point, getting back to your question about representations in the agreement, the last sentence of Section 3.28 that Judge Posner referred to when Mr. Grimm was here, In that provision, PM Ag warranted, represented, that there are no material adverse facts that have not been disclosed to you in this agreement and schedules. The jury could certainly find, and we submit did find, that there were material adverse facts that had not been disclosed. There were also representations in the agreement with respect to there's been no material loss since September 30th, 1997. They had lost $500,000 in a few months on these pig contracts, not disclosed. There is also a representation that there is no fact that we're aware of that would prevent the conduct of this business after the sale in the same manner in which it was conducted before. There was ample testimony before the jury that the effect of these contracts was to convert Bickerton from a pure premix operator to a company that had a significant animal marketing and animal raising and holding component. Again, these are all representations in the agreement. So whatever these integration clauses mean, they certainly do not bar reliance on these various representations. Now, turning to that, Your Honor, these integration clauses, this is not a non-reliance clause such as the court considered in the Rissman case. These are ordinary integration clauses. They say, here's what the contract is. The contract is defined by what we are saying on this piece of paper or this document. There's not a word in that contract that says, as in Rissman, you hereby agree that we didn't make any other representations to you and that you're not relying on anything else in entering into this contract. That's a non-reliance provision. What we have here are integration provisions, and as Judge Posner pointed out, the general rule, and it's the rule in Illinois, is that integration provisions do not bar a claim of pre-contract fraud. And again, the pre-contract fraud only applies to part of what was tried. We also have all the representations in the contract itself. Now, the Burrill case that Mr. Grimm referred to is different. You had close to a non-reliance clause in that contract. It said that the contract supersedes all communications on the subject matter of this agreement, not just all prior agreements and understandings, which is the normal language. It said all communications. It's quite a bit broader than what we have here. Also, the court in Burrill pointed out that there were extensive disclaimers in the contract, disclaimers pertaining to the precise subject matter of the alleged misrepresentations, which had to do with the terms and conditions of the plaintiff's tenure as an Allstate agent in that case. Burrill is also different because what you had there was not a misrepresentation as to a matter of fact, as we have here. It was really, the claim was, you promised me that this is the way the contract was going to be. This was going to be my salary. I was going to have this many accounts. I would have this territorial area. Turned out the contract didn't say that, and that was a claim of fraud. Well, this court held in, for example, the Cosby Iron case, and it really picks up on the opinion in Carr versus Cigna that Judge Posner wrote, when a contract says X, and it's clear and it's, you know, any competent adult can understand it, and you're orally told not X, you can't rely on not X, because if you read the contract, you see it. Well, that's, we don't have that here. This is not a situation where Provimi was told, there, we don't have offsets, there's market risk here, you're going to be owning a lot of pigs, and you, by reading the contract, you could see that, you know, that this was the case. You know, Mr. Grimm points to the fact that they could read the pig purchase contracts and all that, but this is a jury question as to whether it was reasonable to rely on these prior representations, and again, the representations in the agreement itself. I'd like to address the jury instruction question. It's clear in Illinois that contributory negligence is not a defense in a fraud case. This court made that clear in AMPAT and in a series of decisions after that. And in fact, the instruction in this case, with its use of the term recklessness, I submit came right from the prior cases considering this contributory negligence question, closely tracked the language of those cases. The district court explained to the jury that the question is whether Provimi acted recklessly in relying on a misrepresentation. Did it deliberately or recklessly assume a known or obvious risk? That comes right out of Astor, comes right out of AMPAT, Consolidated Bearings, and other decisions of this court. The court told the jury that Provimi could not close its eyes to a known or obvious risk. Again, language straight from AMPAT, Astor, and other cases. And the court told the jury that it was up to the jury to decide whether Provimi's failure to investigate more extensively than it did was reckless. Again, the cases are clear under Illinois law that there's no duty to investigate a counterparty's representations unless the representations are so obviously false or improbable that the failure to investigate is reckless. So we submit that this instruction accurately reflected Illinois law on this question. And incidentally, the IPI instruction just uses the term justifiable reliance. It's basically a list of the elements of fraud, and it says there must be justifiable reliance. It doesn't offer any definition of what that means.
Is there any evidence in the record about whether it is common in this industry for these feed companies to also be speculating in animal prices?
There was no evidence about the industry practice. There was evidence that it was Provimi's policy not to speculate on animal prices. And in fact, that's a written policy, and Vigortone is the only Provimi company that owns any animals, and it's it's unintentional ownership.
Did I take it that the question of justifiable reliance was not before the jury at all?
Oh, no, absolutely, Your Honor, it was. There was a general fraud instruction that listed the elements, including justifiable reliance, and then there was the additional instruction that Mr. Grimm is complaining about that said, here's what justifiable reliance means.
But that's the one that is not part of the IPI.
That's the one that is not part of the IPI, correctly. Correct, Your Honor.
Why does it require, for our purposes, a further definition?
Well, Your Honor, as you can tell from the briefs in this case, this whole case was about justifiable reliance.
No.
There is no dispute that these various representations were made.
No.
There's no dispute that there was actual reliance
right.
on them.
If there is no definition on justifiable reliance, from whence cometh this great definition?
The definition came from cases explaining what justifiable reliance means under Illinois law.
Illinois cases.
Illinois cases and cases of this decisions of this court applying Illinois law, such as AMPAD and Astor, for example.
I was curious as to the relationship of that, for instance, in criminal offense, we have one which we say we do not, reasonable doubt, we don't define.
Right.
Why isn't this analogous to reasonable doubt, justifiable reliance?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that it would have been reversible error if the district court had decided not to instruct on justifiable reliance.
But you think
reliance.
They have a right to give justifiable?
I think it's certainly well within a district judge's discretion when the central issue in a case is, was there justifiable reliance? I think it's certainly reasonable for him to want to give the jury more guidance than just saying those two words. Hmm. And that's what happened here, and the guidance he gave
I would assume that your jury argument would have accomplished that rather than the judge telling them specifically what constitutes justifiable reliance. Isn't that close to a directed verdict?
No, I don't think it's close to a directed verdict, and I'm sure Mr. Grimm's whole argument here certainly is that it's not close to a directed verdict because he thinks this, you know, the evidence is clear no matter what the instruction was. I don't think it was close to a closing argument. Obviously, we could and did make the point in our closing argument, but I think it was perfectly
appropriate. They were justified in not looking any further because they've been told something different.
Correct, Your Honor.
Did your opponent object to the judge's trying to define justifiable reliance, or did he just object to the specific way he did it?
I believe both, Your Honor. I believe he objected that there should be, because there was not a specific IPI instruction that defined justifiable reliance, that there shouldn't be any definition, and by the way, the definition you're giving is wrong. I believe that's the case.
Is there any rule that precludes departures from IPI instruction?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the Illinois Supreme
Court... In either case, there's no rule. Rule says that it specifically, they do not accept it for all cases, but they leave the question to the judge in whatever peculiar circumstances to refer it. But justifiable reliance is not unusual. It doesn't make that take it out of the or ordinary realm of those cases where you have justifiable reliance before you. This case is not unique in that.
Oh, no, it wasn't unique, Your Honor, but it was unusual.
My question was originally pointed out to why didn't the committee consider this, and I'm sure they did, and concluded that it was unnecessary to give any further definition of justifiable reliance, and didn't.
I don't know if that's the case or not, Your Honor. Perhaps they considered it, perhaps they didn't. I don't know.
Well, how would you bet?
I'm not a gambler, Your Honor.
Then you're in the wrong business altogether.
You don't speculate in pork bellies.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Trello. Mr. Grimm, how much time does he have? Minute? Well, we'll give you 2 minutes. So.
No one could take literally a statement that a program of breeding thoroughbred horses was risk-free. Continental Bank versus Meyer, Judge Fairchild's opinion, and no one could take literally a statement that a program of acquiring 250,000 pigs per year to support 6,000 tons of premix sales was risk-free. I think that's the end of it. Now, on the instruction, Your Honor, the gentleman who trained me, now dead, told me once, he said, if you think you've got too many ways to win in the Court of Appeals, you probably do. I think the instructions were wrong. Recklessness was emphasized 4 times. The Illinois pattern instructions are to be given if they state the law. They shall be given is the point. But, Your Honor, there's much more here that we have to worry about. What we have to worry about is the decision that comes down from this court saying 3.28 is ambiguous. I didn't hear counsel argue that any section of the contract was ambiguous when he was here today. It's not ambiguous. It means what it says, because if it meant what they said it says, you absolutely don't need the other integration clauses in the contract. You can just shake hands. Now, if there was one more thing to be needed, and I'll sit down unless you've got a couple of punches to throw at me here, it's just this. What if all you had was the set of circumstances that Judge Rovner wanted to carve out in Rissman, where she said, look, let's not make a rule that any time fraud's alleged, it's absolutely barred if you've got the best integration clause. And you know something? I tend to think she's got to be right, because how could you have a clause that said, if I defraud you and you don't catch me, it's okay. I don't think the court would uphold that kind of a clause on public policy grounds. But think of the totality of circumstances she ticked off in the written and concurring opinion.
But that's your interpretation.
Oh, no. That's the law. Once you have those circumstances, that's the law.
But you said it would be against public policy to say, you know, even if I defraud you, you have no remedy. But that's your interpretation of the integration clause.
No, it isn't, Your Honor. It's a necessary interpretation so every contract isn't relitigated by a claim of oral fraud.
I know, but what's the difference between the integration clause as written and a clause which said, I agree, I agree not to sue you for fraud?
The answer is, it's like enforcing a gambling contract. I think that kind of a statement would be pretty raw, but the point is this, Your Honor. Every contract can have a very, very subtle remembrance of some shade of truth. And besides, this repeated representation that were passed through, not so at all. It was made after all the negotiations were done, allegedly during due diligence to Deloitte and Touche, the same people who didn't have to stand scathing cross-examination for the report they made that Provimi knew all about these contracts and that they were not passed through and that they were substantially risky. And on the question of the financials, they prevailed on that issue in the arbitration and got paid for it on the miscellaneous accounts receivable. They were awarded $500,000 on it. There's only one thing to consider here, Your Honor. Do they get to prove up any proper damages under the law on the non-disclosed contract? There was one contract we didn't disclose, and they're entitled to some damages on it, but they didn't properly prove them, and unless you have more for me, I know my time's up.
Okay, thank you very much.
First case, Your Honor.
Next case for argument is Peter.